good evening. Come in, come in. Welcome to House of Mystery.
Do you have any rooms available?
Yes, we have room for you.
How much for one night?
For you is free. One night. It is raining. And besides, you have a certain quality that we need.
For free? Thanks, man. You're a lifesaver. Man, this place is creepy. It's out in the middle of nowhere. You have any ghosts?
Ghost? No. No ghost. Not yet. But we have everything else. We've got UFO. We've got conspiracy. We've got true crime. Alternate history. But no. No ghost as yet.
Thanks for the room. Do you mind taking me upstairs and showing me the room?
Yes. Yes, of course. This way to the elevator. Here we are. This room is for you.
Hey, you don't need to shove me. Man, this room is dark. I can barely see a thing. Are you sure this is my room?
What the hell is that moving around in the dark?
Sir, the door seems to be locked from the outside.
Now we have ghost. Now it is your turn. Welcome. Will you be needing a room in the House of Mystery?
You have now entered the House of Mystery on KXIM 98.3 FM Iowa with your hosts Al Warren, Kev Thompson, and Julie Sav.
For something a little different, a show filled with British etiquette and humour, from the delightful Julie Saville, a medium working with spirit across the UK. Welcome to the Julie Sav Show.
Pretty woman, won't you pardon me, pretty woman? I couldn't help but see, pretty woman.
Very good evening to you, and welcome to the Julie Sav Show tonight. And with me, I'm joined by Jeff Holder, who is a screenwriter and an author of some of the most amazing paranormal material, where he explores in a multitude of books different theories and scientific evaluations of the paranormal, whether that be from poltergeist to writing thrillers. So thank you for joining me tonight, Jeff.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And just before we were on air, we spoke a little bit about some of the things that you've done that we can touch upon, because there is just so much out there that you have written.
Yeah, I don't have a social life, so I write books instead.
I think that's clear by the sheer volume of books you've written. How many are there in total now?
Well, I've just finished my 40th, but there's a bit of backlog in the publishing world, so I think it's only about 35 out there.
Wow, that's just so. I mean, one of the things I read about you is how well you undertake your research, and it made me think about certainly in my own academic time when I was at university, etc., I was thinking I really disliked researching. I found it really difficult to research things unless I was absolutely passionate about it. And you've researched and written about quite a lot of subjects within the realms of paranormal. So you've got all those books, and then you've got your screenwriting role as well. And I just wondered how different they were.
Well, all the books are non-fiction, they are, as you know, I do a great deal of research for all of those. The screenwriting, where I specialize in horror and the supernatural, those sort of genres, they're great because I can just make things up. That's a completely different muscle. You know, you just move probably different parts of your brain, probably. One is focused very much on what, if not what has definitely happened, what people have said has happened, you know, that is research based. And the other is, well, you know, I'm writing about the supernatural, so I can make it up anything I like.
That's true, isn't it? It's really interesting. So what do you find more interesting, making things up or looking at what people's experiences are?
Well, to be honest, I actually enjoy both to an equal extent. There's nothing I like better on a Monday. I'll be writing a screenplay about zombies. We love zombies. And on Tuesday, I'll be sort of reading some dense academic work that is filled with fascinating insights into European witchcraft in the 17th century or something like that. You know, I find both of them equally fascinating.
You see, I mean, you said about zombies there and, oh, we love zombies. But we are a nation that is fascinated by them. And from different kind of films, etc., that have come out, there's that rejuvenation of interest from young people. And I remember not that many years ago when my children were a bit younger, they said to me, "It's all right, Mum, we've got a plan if there's a zombie apocalypse." And they looked at me it was clear that they had thought this out. And they said, after we've hidden and we've taped up all the windows of the house, etc., and we've popped into town, we've stocked up on food, because we lived in the west coast of Wales at this point. Mm-hmm. They said, then we're going to have to shut the dog out because she's going to give us away. And the problem is, you're going to then cry over the dog, so you're going to have to go too. We're really sorry, but you're going to have to fend for yourself. And I was thought this through.
It's good that you've raised some independently minded children there.
Yeah, so much so they're going to shut me out in a zombie apocalypse in case I grizzle over the dog. So yeah, but they'd absolutely thought it through, and then they went off onto these mad ideas that they had about building different. Tunnels, etc., to get out to sea and all sorts. But kids are generally very interested in what would happen if.
Well, I've got a zombie film is going to be in production. It's going to be filmed later this year in Ohio. And in my film, the zombies are the heroes.
Wow.
The humans are the bad guys. The zombies are the heroes. Mind you, they are articulate zombies, so yeah.
and how have you, has any of that kind of been formed on what we know from history in terms of, different beings in the paranormal world? Has that informed your, that particular...
Not on that film, but there is a synergy between the two writing areas. I've got a job writing a script for a British supernatural thriller.
Yeah.
The reason that the producers came to me is because that they knew I knew a lot about the world of parapsychology, because the central character is a psychic who foresees his death at the hands of a serial killer. Which is good, it's a good story. It's based on a book, and I sort of looked at the book and I thought, well, this guy's kind of like a superhero. He's got all these psychic powers, so he wouldn't have any problem at all. So I sort of listed all the psychic powers. He's got precognition, he's got telekinesis, he's got telepathy, he's got remote viewing, all of these things. And so I was informed of these things. I said, you can't have him do all of these things. You know, he has to be limited. And I said, oh, yeah, no one's ever thought about that before. Maybe, yeah, so you've got the job. So, you know, there is a synergy between the two.
Well, the only thing missing is like a Wonder Woman outfit, and for that to be a woman, and I could do that.
I don't look good in Wonder Woman outfits. I'm sorry. Yeah, it's just not my style.
Maybe it's mine.
Maybe it is. I have no doubt.
That guy, the main character is the wrong sex, clearly.
Well, it is outside my power to change that.
I'm teasing. My day job is actually as a social worker. I manage a team of social workers working in child protection. I'm not quite sure they would like to see me prancing around in Lycra.
Oh, you know, dress down Friday. Yeah,
yeah, maybe. Okay, so, you know, what we've just been talking about really touches on, you said something, and I'm just trying to think back to what it was you said that was absolutely true, and it was, I related it to paranormal investigations, and it was... Yeah, it was about how we go and we look at other people's experiences. So when you're writing about poltergeists, or when you're writing about anything that, say, for example, if we're writing about UFO experiences, etc., we'd be writing about what somebody else is reporting on. That's where the research base comes in. And that's the same with paranormal investigating. You know, we should be going out as teams and investigating somebody's experience, because we're trying to either replicate or understand that experience and the causes of it. So in terms of your research into poltergeist, because you've got a web miniseries currently, What is a Poltergeist? What sort of research did you do initially to understand poltergeist activity and the different theoretical frameworks behind it?
I basically read an awful lot of old books.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's sort of where it started. The poltergeist activity, although obviously it wasn't, nobody used the word poltergeist, because that's a word that dates to the 16th century, I think. But people were describing what we would recognise as poltergeist activity. Well, the earliest case I know is from France, is from the 4th century AD. So there's been centuries and centuries of people writing about poltergeists. And in the early days, there would have been a very distinctive interpretation, because most of the people who were writing about them were members of the Christian Church. And so the sole cause that they could attribute to these outrages were demons. You know, they had to be demons. And then as a secondary cause, they could be caused by witches. You know, of course, witches are human, demons are non-human. So those, for centuries, those were the two causes. Nobody thought about ghosts. As far, if you go look at the sort of the data, you know, the literature up to the Middle Ages, nobody says these things were caused by ghosts. They're caused by demons, or they're caused by witches. Ghosts have come quite late into the sort of the panoply of ideas that people have about what's causing these truly bizarre things. And whereas these days I doubt many people would immediately think, oh, a witch is causing this, because in general, decline, you know, belief in witchcraft has declined. But I'm willing to bet that most people when presented or encounter with a poltergeist would immediately think ghost, that is to say a spirit of the restless dead. But they wouldn't think witchcraft. And like all of these things, things go in fashions, you know. So ghosts are the explanation of the day, where, and you know, witchcraft isn't. But you know, nobody thought that. People thought that differently, you know, 1,000 years ago. And then you go on to the what historians call the early modern period, the sort of 16th, 17th century, and a lot of the records that we find from across Europe, that people are attributing these things to fairies. Now, these aren't the little Tinkerbells of popular imagination. Fairies or brownies or many other household spirits are kind of more like goblins in the term, and they were mercurial, malicious, and to be avoided in many cases at all costs. And so many of the cases that are recorded from that period, people are saying it's the fairies, or it's the brownies, or it's the hobgoblins. They're not saying it's witchcraft, or they're certainly not saying it's ghosts. Ghosts are, you know, pretty late. So you can see there's different interpretations throughout history.
And given your extensive knowledge about, you know, so many reported poltergeist incidents or accounts, where do you sit on that?
Well, I have written two books on poltergeists, and I can tell you with absolute certainty, I have absolutely no idea. I don't know what it is. I mean, the 20th century saw the rise of different explanations, saw the rise of the psychic turmoil of a particular individual, that the poltergeist activity was associated with a focus.
We've seen that in films like Poltergeist when that was first released, didn't we?
That's right. Well, no, actually, I think the first Poltergeist, that's because there's buried, the house is over an Indian burial ground.
Oh, right, okay, yep.
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, that sort of notion of the psychic turmoil of an individual, that's a very much a post-Freudian 20th century idea. Nobody thought about that in the 19th century, though, you know, that was ridiculous. Then you also get a sort of small trail of ideas from the late 19th, early 20th century on the idea of tulpas, the idea that poltergeists are things that have been created by a mind. So they're not sort of insensate turmoil, they are actually deliberately, or perhaps sometimes accidentally, but mostly deliberately created, and that they go off and have a semi-independent life of their own, which is why they're causing all these problems. My favourite, my absolute favourite explanation of all time for what poltergeists are comes from a book published in the 19th century about written by a pair of British aristocrats who'd decided to take a tour in Bulgaria, and there they in the remote villages, they were talking to the villagers about their beliefs, and they were told that there were these kind of problems in these villages with supernatural beings, and they said, well, what's causing these? Because they were obviously describing a poltergeist. They said, what's causing them? They said, oh, that's the invisible vampires.
Wow.
Yeah, and so their belief system put vampires into two parts. Adult vampires were physical, visible beings who behaved like the vampires that we're familiar with from folklore and fiction. But when these vampires were young, when they were in the larval stage, they were invisible, and it was those that were causing the poltergeist cases. And I've never heard anyone else use the idea of the invisible vampires as a poltergeist source, but it remains my favourite idea.
So what are the realms of poltergeist activity that you've seen reported? Because as you rightly said, you know, way back when we're talking kind of sort of 1635, you talked a little bit about a case where it was the first case that you could find that there was a poltergeist that would do domestic kind of
this is the first case in Scotland.
In Scotland, sorry.
In Scotland, so I've written a book on poltergeist in Scotland.
But that was a poltergeist kind of setting the table and sort of undertaking a domestic task. What's this kind of extremes that you've seen in terms of, well, that you've heard reported in terms of poltergeist activity?
One of my sort of favourite cases is from Glenluce, which is in the southwest of Scotland. It lasted for 22 months between the years 1654 and 56, although there were four-month gaps between that. It's like the Polt went on holiday for a few months. And like many poltergeist outbreaks, it sort of started quite small and escalated. It started with sort of whistling noises and rappings and that sort of thing. And then it started throwing great quantities of stones through the doors, through the windows, down the chimney. But although they were thrown with great force, when they hit people, they seemed to slow down and didn't actually hurt people, for the moment anyway. And then the pult got into slashing and cutting the family's clothing, even when they were wearing them, you know, pulling the blankets off beds, and it attacked the livelihood of the family as well. The family were weavers, and weavers worked at home using very large looms, and it cut and destroyed his tools and his loom, so he temporarily lost his livelihood. So that's quite. And then he started, attacking people with pins, so leaving prick marks in the skin, and pulling turf off the roof and off the walls, setting fires, and then this is the bit where it gets really weird. It developed an ego. You know what I was talking about? Things are, everything is fashion. There are different fashions about interpretation. Well, there seems to be fashions in poltergeists as well, because 17th century poltergeists were very voluble. They loved talking. They loved discussing with their people that they were terrorizing. But I can't think of too many modern poltergeists who are that, garrulous. And this one was, it wasn't just that it could speak a lot. It could speak in an educated manner. When the local ministers turned up to expel it, it first addressed them in Latin and then in English, although not pure English. It spoke in Lowland Scots, which was the form of English spoken in that area. And it debated scripture with the ministers back and forth. They were knocking back and forth, quoting the Bible at each other. It mocked them, it shouted at them, and at the end of the day, in front of numerous witnesses, it said that it would bash the brains out of the youngest daughter of the household. Now, at this point, the Polt had been around for a few weeks, and had been vocal for a few weeks. And to just give you the indication of just how normalized this had become, the girl who'd just been threatened with death just shrugged her shoulders and carried on doing her domestic chores because she'd heard it all before.
Wow.
That's just like funny. Then it gets truly weird. The clergymen present and the other witnesses see a naked hand and an elbow beating the floor until the house was shaking. And it was... Then it said to them, "Did you see the hand?" And they said, "That wasn't my hand. That was my father's coming from the pit." And so he claimed to be the son of Satan. And then after 6 months, it just stopped for no reason. 4 months of quiet. It came back with a renewed series of assaults. Not quite so serious, but this time it really had a go at food. All the food was polluted, dirtied, spoiled, so much so that this family, they were a poor family, they were close to starving. And then it just stopped again. And then 4 months holiday, it came back once again, doing the things it was doing before, throwing stones, assaulting the family in their beds with wooden sticks, setting one of the beds on fire. And then it just stopped. One of the things that I find extraordinary and quite fascinating about studying more and more poltergeist cases you read about, the more senseless they seem. They start for no reason. They continue for a day, weeks, months, years in some cases, and then they stop for no reason and the people are never troubled again.
So in terms of the phases that we go through in terms of our belief about how and why poltergeist activity begins, where would that fit?
All the witnesses were convinced that they were dealing with some kind of demon.
Right. And what about the ages of the children in the household? So if we now reflected back and we were saying, okay, so... Yeah. Let's review Is there an adolescent teen or?
Yes, he had, if I remember, I think he had several children of various ages, not given their exact ages, and they also had a servant. The youngest daughter, we're not given her age, she was the first one to be threatened, being thrown in by a voice thrown her into the well, they thought at the time that perhaps it was connected to one of the members of the family, but they couldn't be, they weren't really convinced. They didn't get anything out. All we're told is that they had children of various ages. I think about five, I think. So that might have included a teenager. In fact, there's a good chance that they included a teenager, but you know, the records are not, just don't tell us that.
Interesting, isn't it? Because there's so many different theories about how and why, as you say, we go through these phases of beliefs. And then when you look at something as early as 1635, and there are so many, again, of those beliefs at play.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, they would see it that way, would they?
Yeah, and there was another case in the same sort of neck of the woods, just from 1695, where although they thought it was a demon, there was a sense that people were thinking that perhaps it was focused on one of the children in the household, and he sent all his children away to the neighbours, and had them come back one at a time, which is very interesting. It's quite like an experimental activity. And when one of his sons returned, the activity broke out again. So it suggested that he might have been the focus. But we're not told exactly how old he is, other than that he was young. So he was probably a teenager.
And you've done a lot of statistical work in terms of those cases you've looked at in Scotland. How did you break up the, it's 134 cases you recorded. How did you break them up in terms of your statistics?
Well, I just looked at the various activities and, you know, and came up with sort of sensible categories. This is sort of at 134 cases over almost 400 years. And the most frequent activity in these poltergeist cases was the movement of objects or furniture. And that took place in almost 72% of cases. So that was the thing that probably, and I think if we think about it, that's probably what people would notice the most, would be the moving of things. And noises, such as taps, knocks, bangs, cries, thumps, and all that kind of thing, those were present in almost 66% of the cases. So objects moving and noises were by far the most frequent of the phenomena reported over almost four centuries. Something that I thought was very interesting, because I'd always assumed that poltergeist cases weren't really associated with apparitions, but I found that if I included anything that you could categorize as an apparition, which might include shadows, moving shadows, that 27% of the cases featured apparitions of some kind or another. I was surprised to discover such a high percentage. And just behind that was displacement. That's, you know, that's when an object disappears from one part place and is found elsewhere. So that occurred in a quarter of all cases as well.
I'm surprised with the apparition.
Yeah,
I'm not surprised it's so high, because that's how I think historically and even today people will describe that kind of poltergeist, you know, something that's noisy that you can hear and see much more than a ghost, which is kind of either residual or just kind of stood in front of you, etc. But in terms of poltergeist activity, what's interesting actually, that all of those categories you would see play out on many paranormal television programs day in, day out, but they're not called poltergeists.
No, but you know, you say tomato, I say tomato.
Yeah, and that's not to criticise. I'm wondering whether or not that's because of public perception around the term poltergeist.
Yeah, I think it's possible.
People tend to see that as a more scary sort of entity to come across. It's something that as soon as you say, oh, it's a poltergeist, it means something might be thrown at you, because that's how you know, it's been presented in the past. And of course then when you have television programs on air which clearly are saying, oh, this has been thrown, you know, oh, the book's landed here, I can hear this, tap three times, that's all coming under that kind of poltergeist activity, but the word is not used.
The word is not used because I think in our current times we prefer the word ghost. We're comfortable with the idea of ghosts, the idea of the restless undead for some reason. That's something that is that's the fashion at the moment and has been for some time. Poltergeists, I think ghosts are a little bit comforting and poltergeists are scary because poltergeists don't seem to be very human. That's the sense that I get. They don't seem to act in ways that we can really easily understand. Poltergeists are other, whereas ghosts are us, and I think that difference is very very key to the way that people talk about these things. I mean, and looking at the other things that that were less common in these cases, I've got. Doors being unlocked or locked or opened or closed, damage to objects and furniture, throwing of stones, very common in early cases in 17th, 18th century, not so common these days. Electrical effects, this is quite interesting. Over a quarter of cases from the time when electricity became common in houses feature some form of electrical effects. Assaults. They're relatively common. Voices, yeah. Fire, smoke. 10% of the cases featured witchcraft or magic, but they were all early cases. None of those are contemporary cases. Apports, objects that appear out of nowhere. They appeared in only 7% of the cases. Food being interfered with. What very, very common in the 18th and 19th centuries. Very uncommon now. People reporting invisible hands, about 7% again. Temperature effects, low temperatures, usually low temperatures, very rarely high temperatures. Water, I thought this was interesting, only 7% of cases involved some form of water, and the same percentage involving writing. And a slightly lower percentage involving smells. But where smells were involved, they were all vile. And quite a lot of modern cases involve smells. Interesting thing, fairies. Fairies being mentioned in 5% of the cases. Once again, these are all older cases, particularly 19th century cases. In 6 cases, the poltergeist either named itself or responded to names that were suggested by the humans present. In 5 cases, there was music or tunes involved. And then you got other things such as, telephone effects, clothes being slashed, animals being interfered with, voices imitating the living, blood and maggots appearing in the kitchen. And nice. So, poltergeists are not wanted on the voyage. People are kind of okay with the idea of ghosts, They've got messages for us from the beyond. But poltergeists, now they're just like, they're just like really violent, unpleasant, unpredictable guest at the party that you want to leave immediately. And I think that's what they're. So those are the sort of the activities that I was recording from those 134 cases.
But it's interesting how many of those still play out today. Okay, we get less of the food and the maggots and the blood, but we still definitely get many of the other effects that you've listed. Yeah. You see written reports from paranormal groups, investigative science. You still see the same recordings, so that kind of thing's moving. Interesting about the writing one. I think that is quite interesting, and the water, because there's lots of different theories around water and paranormal activity. So, I found that's quite an interesting figure. In terms of more recent investigations and poltergeist activity, what's one of the more recent ones that you've considered?
For me, recent is the 19th century. Yep. The I'm just a little cautious about dealing with recent cases, because in many instances the individuals concerned are still alive, yeah. And I just don't like intruding or talking too much about those cases. It's something that I'm uncomfortable with. I'm happy with the older cases, but modern stuff, I'm going, well, you know, this is a family who might have suffered unwanted attention. I don't think I want to talk too much about that. Yeah.
Okay, so if I reframe that slightly then, obviously, you know, as part of your research, you will have come across cases more recently. And I guess, have you had the opportunity to experience poltergeist activity yourself, not just from reported incidents, but actually witnessed anything yourself?
Well, I can tell you this. As part of my professional research, all the books that I've written, I have spent endless hours in allegedly haunted castles and theatres and homes. I have explored tunnels and secret passages. I've spent nights in prehistoric monuments. You know, I have been on vigils. I've gone to places that are reputed to have various kinds of paranormal activity. And in all that time, not once have I had a paranormal experience. I'm a very boring individual.
I'm sure you're not a boring individual.
I just think that the whatever it is they are, just don't want to come out and play when I'm there, because they go, oh, look at him, he's boring, you know. No, he's a skeptic, and we're not going to go out and you know show what we can do. We'll wait for the we'll wait for the next crowd. So not once have I had any kind of paranormal experience.
In terms of and it does link to that, this next question, but in terms of obviously how things were reported and how people perceived activity, you know, many years ago, and now we're very much into that kind of scientific evaluation of and. If every angle of a room is not covered, then we wouldn't believe it to be true. And even then, we go further than that to say, well, actually, you've got to be there to believe it, and then you can't kind of sell the idea anyway. So in terms of reporting, our reporting measures have changed considerably and are as fashionable, I'm sure, as the beliefs around poltergeist activity. Is there anything any theme that you can kind of pick out of some of those cases that we spoke about where people are observing and recording and reporting it in a specific way, or is it very much just almost like a story that gets passed from person to person?
One of the big changes takes place in the middle of the 19th century with the rise of spiritualism, and you and your readers will all know a great deal about spiritualism, but it changed the way that people interpreted what was actually happening. And this is particularly the case because if there was an event took place that was in a relatively small town, not in the city centre, there would be very few people who would feel qualified, if that's the word, to investigate. But with the rise of spiritualism, a class of people in Scotland, in Britain, and right across the world, sort of took it upon themselves to become self-appointed experts at interpreting various phenomena. So time and time again, in the cases in Scotland, in the 19th century, what you find is that someone is having a poltergeist experience in their home. They contact, you know, the police, they contact the civil authorities, everyone's at a loss. And then the spiritualists turn up, you know, they just turn up and say, we are experts and we can interpret this. And of course, what they do, they always interpret the poltergeist activity as being messages from beyond. Mm. And because they are always, and you can tell this from the reports, they're always middle class or above. They are always educated. They are always confident. And they always have a sort of a manner about them. The authorities, well, I haven't got a clue what to do about these things, go, yeah, okay, you can come in and tell us what's going on, because you can see that they're acting out of desperation. So whereas a century before, people said, oh, that's the witches or it's the demons or whatever. In the 19th century, what you find is confident, self-appointed experts, usually from the world of spiritualism, are turning up. Now, we have to be very grateful to them, because the great thing that they did is that they usually recorded their cases. So even though they had one interpretation of what's going on, with any paranormal case, whether it's a poltergeist or anything else, there are two phases. One is the event and the recording of the event, and the second is the interpretation. So you may or may not agree with the interpretation that spiritualists had, but the great thing is that they did record the events, and it's thanks to them that we know a great deal about 19th century poltergeist cases.
And now, of course, spiritualism still has a big role in terms of paranormal investigating. And I don't mean that in terms of just going out there ghost hunting in groups. I mean that in terms of being another part of any kind of science that people bring to the table. It's just another part of a bigger investigation into something. But of course, probably less recorded by somebody who was spiritualist and more now leaning on the scientific approaches, because that's where we're at today.
Well, for example, there's a case from Port Glasgow in 1864, in a tenement flat where poor industrial workers were living. Very intensive sort of poltergeist activity, all the usual things you would expect, movement, noises, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And the police were involved because huge crowds were turning up outside this place and blocking the hallway and blocking the street, and the authorities didn't have a clue. And so a local spiritualist who was, I think he was a merchant, and he turned up and just, he wasn't asked, he just turned up and said, I'm here to help, I can, and they said, yeah, okay, you know what you're talking about, come in. These days, that wouldn't happen. These days, what would happen was that a paranormal group would come knocking on your door and say, we're the experts, we're here to help. Yeah, come in, you can, because we haven't got a clue what's going on. So, you know, it's horses for courses. 19th century, you've got experts who were spiritualists. These days, you've got experts who are paranormal groups. Yeah.
And what's out of all of the cases that you've obviously, deeply researched and looked into, what's your favourite one? I know you mentioned the one earlier in terms of the Glenn Luce one, but apart from that, what would really stand out for you as being
this one is the one I mentioned earlier, the one in Port Glasgow, 1864. And the reason is because with my scriptwriter hat, I always think visually. You know, when I'm telling the story, I'm always looking for the visual story. I don't want just people sitting in the room talking. I want to see something that sort of will make people go, whoa, you know. And so there's an element in this. So it was a very small tenement apartment, family crammed in there, you know, typical industrial claustrophobia. And you have two police officers, and you have this merchant who is also a spiritualist. And they'd been told that the Pult tended to be most active between 7 and 10 p.m. So they turned up about then, and they just waited. About 9 p.m., the scratching started, and this was followed by the pulse signature sound, which was what sounded like a sledgehammer hitting different parts of the tenement. And it seemed to come from beneath the bed. So the police officers, who obviously only had candles and lanterns at this point, were investigating. They were going around searching for the source of this noise. They couldn't find anything. Then the sort of tappings, knockings, raps started, and the spiritualist there thought, you know, that sounds like a tune. And so he whistled the tune, and the knocks banged away in time to this tune. So then he whistled another popular Scottish air of the time, and the pult banged away in time to the tune. So they all started whistling the most popular one, which is Scots Wahey, and the pult joined in. So I love this idea that of a musical pult, you're joining in with their whistling. That's not very common. And then it gets even weirder. Bangings continue. So they're going, right, there must be something here. police officer goes downstairs to the tenement below. There's no one's doing those noises there. It's coming from the tenement. They move all the furniture. They can't find anything. They get a pickaxe and they tear up part of the floorboards. And they end up with a big hole in the floor. Presumably someone's going to pay for this to be repaired later, but they're looking at it. So I have this image of two police officers, the merchant, the family, all leaning over this hole in the floor with their candles and banging coming from the hole where there's nothing to bang onto. And I thought, that's just such a visual thing. I just thought, that would just be great because that would just, you know, that is just like a movie, that is. Yeah, and then, by the way, it just went away, the bolt. Just, you know.
Just disappeared.
So that would be a very bad movie, you know, because it would just disappear and then people go, oh, there's no ending, you know. Let's go and get that screen. Yeah.
How many of how much of your research has informed your screenwriting? So is there anything you can say? Is there a particular piece of Poltergeist research that you've said
not from Poltergeist, because I haven't actually written about a Poltergeist in a screenwriting context. One day that will happen, but some of the stuff in my other books have informed some of my other scripts, but not directly Poltergeist 3.
And for the benefit of everyone listening, Jeff, what have been the topics of some of your other books?
Oh, you know, I just deal with really dull subjects, you know.
You certainly don't.
Witchcraft, ghosts, stone circles, folklore, earth mysteries, sea monsters, Loch monsters, cryptozoology, zombies, bloody history, very bloody history, diseases, torture, prison, punishment, zombie. I've said zombies already, but you know, you get that impression. Can you tell that as I was a very morbid child?
Yeah, it's worrying, isn't it?
You get that sense, yeah.
I do. Full of joy.
Yes, that was me. That was me. Happy. I was a little ray of sunshine.
Yeah, I'm sure. How can people get a hold of you, Jeff, or look into some more work that you do? You've got your website, haven't you, jeffholder.com?
Yeah, jeffholder.com, that's where most of the sort of, that's where I mostly move in mysterious ways. But I'm also on Twitter, jeffholder58, and I'm on, you know, that there Facebook. And if you're in the business world, if you're in the film world, I'm on LinkedIn as well. And you know, so you know, there's all sorts of places where you can connect and find out what it is that I'm up to, which is mostly staring at a blank screen and drinking tea. That's mostly what I'm up to, but you know, what I pretend is that I'm working hard.
Mm. Well done, you don't do it very successfully with all those books.
Thank you.
Well, Jeff, it's been a real pleasure talking to you this evening, and we've learned a lot about Scottish history and Poltergeist and the theories that we go through, I suppose, she says as she stumbles all over her words. But, you know, those kind of phases that we go through, those fashionable ideas about what poltergeist activity is, where they come from, to today's current place where there is still that lack of understanding. We're still running around trying to find out what poltergeist is. We're still defining it differently depending on where you live. Mm-hmm. And what group you're part of. And I've no doubt at all that in 50 years' time we could be having the same interview saying the same things because we'll have just moved to a different fashionable state.
Or there will have been a paradigm shift and, you know, someone in the scientific community will actually be able to establish communication with a poltergeist and will be, you know, the world will have changed.
I can't believe you don't think that's already not already happened.
Well, I'm not saying a word. I'm stum. Yeah.
Even as a medium, when I work with people, I will always say, do not make a leap of faith. If you can't take what I'm saying, don't take it. Because the power of suggestion is such a strong a strong indicator of kind of the next step, what happens next. And we see that from people like Derren Brown, etc., and how easily people can be manipulated. Mm-hmm. And certainly from attending investigations, etc., I've seen the power of suggestion work so wonderfully and so easily, with no effort at all from anybody there. And one of the things you were talking about earlier is this kind of poltergeist that listen, and they kind of respond to the name that people give them. And the amount of times I've sat in a group and watched people say, "Does your name begin with A?" And the planchette doesn't move. "Does it begin with B?" It doesn't move. They might get up to the letter S and somebody goes, and it moves. And they go, "Oh, is it Sarah?" "Yes, that's it." I'm like, oh, my word.
Yes.
How did that just happen? How did you think that was okay? But that's, the power of suggestion is a massive influence, isn't it?
It is. But let's sort of step back from that a moment. One of the possibilities, I have no idea whether this is true or not, one of the possibilities is that poltergeists are some kind of discarnate entity. Let's say, for example, that they might be. This notion of responding to names that are suggested to them is actually deeply manipulative. If they are discarnate entities, if being, you know, the big word, then they're, what they're doing, they are toying with the individual. I always have this image in my head: the poltergeists are like they're like the adolescents on glue of the paranormal world. You know, imagine them sort of, you know, wherever they are, just go. "Did you see what he did that? He suggested our name, and I said that was our name. Oh, and he believed him." That's like, there's something juvenile, pure, yeah, about poltergeists. And if they are discarnate entities, they're not super smart, I don't think, but they may be manipulative. So suggest the names, I'm not sure that's a very good idea.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, thank you, Jeff. It has been really interesting, and you know, there's so many more things I could talk with you about, because there's so many different subjects that you've researched. And I'm sure if it's okay with you, I'll come back to you and have another conversation about different things, whether that might be about your zombies or something else that you've written about.
It would be a pleasure.
Lovely. Well, thank you so much for tonight. And everybody, jeffholder.com is where you'll find all the up-to-date information and reviews for Jeff's books. And as Jeff has already said, you can find him on Twitter and Facebook. Just one more thing, Jeff, where can people buy your books? Where's the easiest place to buy them?
Well, you can buy them through the website, or you can go onto that there, Amazon. And, you know, they're all there.
Fantastic. Thank you ever so much, and you take care.
You too. Cheers.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
Welcome to Stephen's True Crime Commentary. Discussions of forensics, how it's done, and true crime interest.
Hello, welcome back to Stephen's True Crime Commentary, and I am Stephen David Lampley. Welcome. Did you know that all, and I said all, of the world's digital information that is currently available in all forms could be stored on just 2 grams of human DNA? Today we're going to talk about DNA, and I'm going to try to make it interesting, because I'll be honest, to me, DNA is a pretty boring subject. It does have some amazing applications in crime and forensics. This is the first part of a series on DNA. All right, so stay with me on this. Some of you are probably thinking, DNA, yawn, yawn, yawn. I'm going to listen to something else, and I'll come back after the DNA segment's over. I get that, okay? I'm going to try to make it interesting, and I'm trying to give you some facts and some trivia about DNA that's going to make it more interesting. DNA is really a good crime-solving tool. All right, what is DNA? DNA, the name for DNA is deoxyribonucleic acid. Okay, there'll be a test after this, so make sure you take notes. I'm just kidding. All right, DNA is a thread-like, ladder-looking chain that's responsible for carrying the genetic instructions for a variety of functions, such as basic functioning, the development, growth, and reproduction of organisms, and even some viruses. DNA is a powerful, powerful tool. Simply put, though, DNA is the hereditary material in organisms. Did you know that humans share 50% of their DNA with bananas? All right, so next time you're in the store, walk over to the banana section, wave, and say, "Hey, cuz, do humans share 50% of their DNA with bananas?" Try finding them on your family tree, okay? Okay, now this thread-like material that is found in each cell, okay, now the DNA that's found in each cell, if it was straightened out and laid end to end, it would measure approximately, listen carefully, it would measure approximately 10 billion miles. Go look it up if you don't believe me, okay? 10 billion miles. That's enough to go to Pluto and come back home again. Each DNA strand is approximately 1.8 meters long, and it's compacted into a space, folks, that's 9/100ths of a micrometer. We're talking some really amazing facts here. DNA is located in the part of the cell called the nucleus, and the nucleus is basically the brain of the cell. Now, this packaged form of DNA is often referred to as a chromosome. All right, now let's talk about genome for a moment, and then we're going to end up, and we'll come back next time and then continue on with DNA. Genome. What in the crap is a genome? A genome is a person's total genetic material. It's everything that is involved in genetics. That's a person's genome. Right? A person's genome is so expansive that it would take a person 50 years working 8 hours a day, typing 60 words a minute, to type out the entire human genome. So when we talk about DNA, we're talking about something that's miraculous. All right, our time is up today. We will come back next time and continue our discussion on DNA, and I'm going to try to give you some more information. We're going to actually get through basically telling you what DNA is so that when we get on to the forensics part, you'll understand it. We're going to talk about the forensics parts of that as far as crime and court. So it's been a pleasure being with you again. I look forward to having you back next time.
Thank you for tuning in to Stephen's True Crime Commentary, and we welcome you to check out Stephen's book, Outside Your Door, a collection of true crime stories right from Stephen's case file and street experience. You want true crime? Let Stephen take you to the streets with him. It doesn't get much more real than from the officer and undercover SVU detective himself. 5-star rated with Amazon, Barnes, and Noble, and Books a Million. Real cases. Real stories. Real people. Outside Your Door, by Stephen David Lampley.
Stephen's True Crime Commentary is a production of Something Weird Media and West 53rd Productions, with music by JasonLampley.com.